In today's episode of the Neil Wilkins podcast, I am really excited to tell you that we're joined by somebody who knows a bit about growth. Eric Eden joins us on the podcast today. Eric is the chief marketing officer for a VC firm that has actually 30 portfolio companies and advises them on growth strategies. So nobody is better qualified to talk to us about how we can see marketing and all its facets as an investment rather than a cost. So welcome to the podcast, Eric.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks for having me.
I mean, you and I have, I guess, both kind of grown up in our marketing and our kind of activities through this whole kind of mindset of you can't stand still. I mean, is that fair to say?
Yeah, I've always been excited about working for growth companies and doing epic things. Like, I don't want to just sort of do whatever is needed to get by. Like, I've always wanted to work for tech companies that and do marketing for them that is like great, that it has a great result.
And I guess really sort of being very kind of sort of VC backed or angel investor backed sort of throughout, you know, many, many years of your career. And I guess my mindset associates kind of with that in terms of positivity and like an innovative kind of mindset. Is it kind of fair to say that this is really an attitude as much as it is about the kind of the practicalities of how you do it?
It's really a way of life. You know, the idea behind working for VC and PE backed companies, which is what I've done for my entire career, is they're looking for very high growth, like 100% a year. And that's a very difficult thing to do, generally speaking, when it comes down to the tactics to get that sort of growth, because VC firms are looking for, generally, they invest for 4 or 5 years and they'd like to get something like 5 to 10 times return on their investment. So you really need that sort of growth and revenue to get there. And what I've really been focused on my career is how do you drive that via marketing? And so there's a lot of things involved in that, including like closely working with the sales teams. But, you know, that's what I really like doing. That's what I'm passionate about, is being a growth driver.
I guess we're just kind of taking a few steps back to kind of where this all begins in many ways. I mean, one of the things I guess that I'm starting to think about here, sort of in this conversation, is kind of, okay, if it's having the right kind of mindset, that kind of welcoming in the idea that 100% growth is a possibility rather than just a default setting, because it isn't, I think, for most organizations and most individuals. It's, if I can just continue to do what I'm doing, it's enough. This is something that really pushes those, I guess, boundaries of expectation way beyond the natural, or way beyond a static or commoditized sector. This is something that is kind of really out there, isn't it, for a lot of people. So where do you kind of begin then to begin those kind of conversations, to begin planning for something like this sort of growth?
Well, I think a lot of it starts with having the right people on the team who have this in their DNA, that they want to do this. And I think an interesting story about this is that one company I worked for, the founder and CEO had an idea that he wanted to hire people not just based on their skills, but culturally on certain cultural values. And one of the 7 cultural values he had really stuck with me was he wanted to hire people who aspire to be remarkable. And I thought that was really interesting, because most places that I've worked for hired based on skills that people had to do the particular job, which makes sense, but it's sort of an order of magnitude higher. And when I drilled into what that meant, it means people who are competitive. So people who, you know, for example, in college played in sports, they're going to be doing more than the minimum required of them. And what I learned is when I started interviewing people, and I would ask people in your last marketing job, when I was hiring people for my marketing team, say you were at this other company for 2 or 3 years, tell me the best one or two things you did when you were there. And it's amazing how many people could, in the interview process, could just not even articulate something great that they had done. Some of them would say, I don't know, or they would mention something sort of mediocre, or they would give an excuse like, well, we didn't have budget, or my boss didn't let me, or something like that. And people do get into situations where they're limited, and that's unfortunate. But, you know, if people have had 5 years experience, you'd hope that they could share something great that they had done. But the reality is, as I worked at companies and had large marketing teams of 100 plus people over the years, what I realized is, unfortunately, most people aspire to be mediocre. And I say this because if you think about, you know, a lot of companies grade people on a scale of 1 to 5, 5 being excellent, 1 being they should be terminated. 80% of the people end up being 3. And it's like a bell curve, right? 10% of people are 1 or 2, 10% of people are 4 or 5, really strong performers. But 80% of people just sort of do C or B quality work because they feel like they don't have to do A quality work. They can just do what they need to do to skate by. And it's somehow disappointing to see that that's, you know, how a lot of people approach things, because the reality is you do end up making a lot more money if you're a top performer and do A quality work. But a lot of young people just don't think about it that way unless they're trained like that. So I've been lucky that I've gotten to hire a lot of people who do aspire to be remarkable and do great things. And they really have this mindset of they're going to be competitive, they're going to work hard, they're going to turn in A quality work. And you need to build a team of people like that in order to really drive the results. Because if you don't have the right team, it doesn't really matter what technology or programs or channels or tactics you're using. Like, all of that sort of becomes noise if you get people who are just sort of mailing it in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think I just love the fact that you've started here kind of with this as being a starting point. It's about the people, because I think it's often very easy when you sort of think of growth and you go straight to the spreadsheets, or you go, you know, straight to those kind of process discussions. And, you know, I think for a lot of businesses, that's where they'll go because they want to see the numbers to then advocate the fact that we're looking for growth. But actually, the starting point is about getting that similar set of or similar mindset of people around you, so you can begin to have those really exciting, very progressive, very innovative kinds of conversations. Do you find then, with those kinds of people in the room, so if you surround yourself with the kind of people that you're talking about there, that it becomes very spontaneous, it becomes very kind of fast and energetic? Or is there still a place for good kind of solid theoretical planning behind it too? Do the two things go hand in hand? Is it possible to have both? Or is it just purely that spontaneity then, because of the nature of the energy of these kinds of people, that kind of takes precedent?
You can't train passion into people. That's the thing. So if people don't love what they're doing, if they're not passionate about it, you can't tell people, like, can you be more passionate? So, like, that's not really something people generally are or they aren't. It's a very binary thing. So you have to have good planning. But when people are passionate and they care and they give a damn, it makes all the difference in the world. And just a very interesting thing is that I know a lot of your listeners are on the West Coast, and I've done some work over the years in the Bay Area, working with people out there. And I'm based in Washington, D.C., which is a lot more people in tech in the D.C. area, a lot more in government tech. And the interesting thing is, like, when I would interview people for companies I worked at in the Bay Area and work with them, you run into people out there that have that passion, and they're like, I went to Stanford. And they pound on the table and they're like, I'm going to be somebody. Like, they are very, like, you can tell, like, it's not a mystery. You can, when you meet these people, you'll know that you've met them. Versus a lot of the people, having hired a lot of tech people in the DC area, the majority of people who work in government, IT and tech, it's a much different mindset, because a lot of government projects in the US, tech projects, these projects are 6-year contracts that really should be completed in 6 months, but they sort of come in and do an hour of work a day and then surf the web and read the paper. And like, it's very bizarre. Like, it's, they're very not driven people. So I think that having people with that passion, who are ambitious, who have a healthy amount of drive in them, really makes all the difference. Of course, you have to have still good planning. It's not all about the emotion and letting that drive everything. But if you don't have that passion component in people, you can't get a top 1% result of like getting 100% growth a year. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I'm wondering what the kind of the second ingredient in this amazing recipe that we're trying to construct here. You may already have, you know, this list of, you know, priorities here, and be really interested to get into that with you. But I'm wondering, is curiosity on the list as well? Because I'm feeling that from the people that I see who and talk to who are different, and some of them start to kind of, I guess, come through with the same kind of values, the same kind of impetus that you're describing there from these individuals. I'm just wondering, is curiosity in the mix of things? Because you can have all the passion in the world, but if you're not necessarily curious as to how things work or how I can improve this or how I could maybe pivot what I'm doing here and do something subtly different, is the curiosity of kind of continuous improvement, to use a management consultant sort of phrase there, is that also a really important ingredient?
Absolutely. One of the CMO groups that I'm in, of about 300 CMOs, that we do networking and we share best practices with each other, that's actually the main criteria for the group. Is you have to be curious. And the guy who leads the group is essentially says, you know, if people aren't curious, I don't want them in the group. Like, it's just, there's no point. And I'm actually a very curious person. When I talk to other marketing leaders who are working at growth companies, I usually ask them what they're doing, how they're doing it, because I don't think that I have all the answers. Even after doing marketing for 20 years, I want to know what's new, what's working for them, how they're achieving great things, because I learn literally every day new things that other people are doing that, you know, I didn't know that was a thing, because it's so complex at the end of the day. There's so many channels and tactics and variables that there's a lot of great things that people come up with. But if you're not curious, to your point, you'll never really discover those things.
So when you kind of have that curiosity, you have that passion, I'm guessing then there needs to be some sort of level of you know, kind of, I guess, sort of innovation. Something's got to actually be part of an output, hasn't it? Because, you know, we could spend all of our time networking, all of our time, you know, being excitable and, you know, trying to embrace the next thing. But then there has to be, and I'm guessing you see this a lot in the kind of the VC sort of world as well, there has to be some level of practicality, because we need to see a deliverable. I mean, to your point about, you know, 6-year projects could probably be done in 6 months if you've got the right kind of focus. It is kind of the next thing on the list, and if I've missed something, please correct me, but is the next thing on the list then getting a little bit practical about stuff, you know, selecting what it is we're going to focus on from all these opportunities and all this exciting energy that we've got buzzing around us now? Is it about then just getting down and starting to do some work?
It is. I think one foundational thing that comes after having the passion and the curiosity is that you actually have to have something really good to market. I've worked for companies that didn't have a product yet. And they're like, well, can you pre-sell it for us? Can you pre-market it? I was like, okay, yeah, I can do that. If it's going to be out in like, you know, if it's going to be out in 3 months, you know, I can get momentum going, get people excited, tell a story about it. But actually, in this one case, I worked for a company and they told me it was going to be out in 3 months. I started doing the marketing. I sold like $10 million of it via marketing and sales before the product was even done. And they actually never built the product. Like, it never got released. And like a year into it, I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing with my life. So I just use that extreme story that the best marketing in the world can't solve not having a good product, right? So at the end of the day, you have to have something that is good, really good to market and sell to get growth in, because a lot of times you just can't solve lack of having a product with marketing. So I think that's a pretty foundational part of it, just to sort of, because I actually work with companies all the time that they're not in the extreme position where they don't have a product at all, but the product isn't there. It needs another year of work, another 2 years of work. And that's just sometimes the reality of things. But, you know, a lot of companies decide not to invest in marketing until they're ready, because if you don't have the product, you're just sort of using your bullets too early.
I was going to ask you about that, really, because I mean, I think for those of us who aren't in a sort of VC style world, and we are maybe in, you know, quite established, maybe kind of quite old school style companies, and I know a lot of the audience, particularly some of the sectors here in the UK, are very well established. I mean, you could say these are commodity products that we're playing with here that might be just tuned slightly, and we'll call that a relaunch, you know, because there isn't this kind of, you know, big revolution, if you like, of technology. It might just be something that evolves steadily and gradually. How do, I mean, if you were, say, you know, part of an investment group that were looking at an organization like that because you saw potential, how does that kind of shape up with this kind of mindset of, you know, going very quickly, being very agile, being very energetic? How would that kind of play out? Are there things that we can learn from VC world that could also play out in a more steady kind of environment, let's call it?
Yeah, I think that when people raise venture capital, the thing that is always a big part of the discussion is, how are you going to invest the money that's being invested with you? So if somebody gets a $5 million investment, the question is, what are they going to spend it on? Are they going to spend it on product development? Are they going to spend it on sales and marketing? And, you know, what ratio over time are they going to spend that money? And I think the crucial thing is, it's an investment. So marketing is not really spend, but it's an investment. So in the venture capital world, if somebody's investing $5 million in a company, and then that money is being invested in marketing, it's not operational spend, it's an investment, because what you're measuring is, okay, what is my return? For every marketing dollar, do I get $10 in revenue? And you should be looking at it very, very deeply in a lot of different ways to say, well, what is our return on investment by product, by geography, by channel that we're doing? Like, the return would be different for online advertising as compared to in-person events, as compared to email marketing. Like, and you have to have sort of the right mix of investments, sort of just like a portfolio, so that you have the blended number of return on investment from all the things you're doing in marketing makes sense. And, you know, I think SaaS companies have done the best job that, and there's been a lot of private equity, like 10,000 SaaS companies have gotten investments from private equity and venture capital, but they actually developed SaaS metrics, which are, I think, some of the most advanced way of thinking about marketing return on investment. So they look at things like statistics, like, what is the customer acquisition cost fully loaded across sales and marketing? They look at things like customer acquisition costs compared to the lifetime value of a customer. They look at things like, what is the payback ratio for every dollar you're spending on sales and marketing? And they have a very sort of advanced set of metrics that investors will look at. And I think that it's actually helpful, even if companies aren't SaaS companies or VC backed, that they look at these methods of analyzing their return on investment. Because even if they're not venture capital backed, marketing is still an investment, and it's still a much better way of thinking about how much do you spend on marketing, or when do you spend the money on marketing. So many days people just come up with, like, hey, maybe we should spend $10,000 on this. And I'm like, well, maybe, but what is the result of that? And what is the return on the investment? It's very interesting how a lot of more traditional, not necessarily growth businesses, they would just say, we'll just take like 5% of our revenue and spend that on marketing. And you can do that, but that's not really the best way of looking at it, if you will.
I love the way you've just described that about, you know, spending that 5%, because then it's spent, it's gone, it's a cost. And that's so different, isn't it, to, you know, the SaaS model that you've just described there, which is, it's almost like really sharpening the saw, as it were. It's really kind of focusing in at a forensic level to say, look, if we are going to invest in this, we need to see a return. And of course, being a VC, that is why you're in business. That is the whole kind of purpose of who and what you are. So there's a kind of a real, well, it's not even implied pressure here. There is an absolute pressure, because if you're going to get our money, then you are going to prove to us that you're actually giving us return on our investment. Because this ROI, return on investment, is just bandied around, I think, by a lot of marketers. And I'll be kind of brutally honest here, the ones that a lot that I see just bandied around. It's like, yeah, we do some ROI stuff. And actually, they don't. It's not actually proving it. It's vanity metrics. It's a little bit of noise. It's just getting them through the next month without being too challenged. But what you're describing here, Eric, is very much that the world that you're in is, it has to be proper, tangible, evidence-based return on investment. It has to be real, because if it isn't, then you're not performing against that investment we've just made into you as a business. So it's pretty, for I think a lot of people hearing this, it's pretty ruthless, really. Is that kind of how it feels, both from a VC backed, but also being the VC? Is it kind of a really, really sort of tough negotiation, but then there's tough terms that you're committing to?
Being a leader is one in marketing is one of the hardest things, for this reason, because when you talk about the marketing budget and how much is going to get invested, and then you're trying to manage the expectations of people in terms of what they'll get as a result of investing that money, that's the hardest thing. And in my experience, I worked for one company for 10 years, and this is a growth company, SaaS company. And when I started there, it was very small, and there was literally no significant marketing budget. It was like $50,000. So like every dollar I spent, I was sweating, right? And what we did was using the SaaS metrics formulas and being able to show the return on investment, what happened was, over a period of 10 years, the marketing budget increased to being more than $30 million in year 10. And it wasn't because they just like got to know me and trusted me. It was because every quarter we would review the results, and they would say, hey, we are getting this return on investment that we expected. For every dollar in marketing, you know, we're getting this amount back, which is the amount we want. And because of that, they would say every quarter, they would say, if we give you more money, if we give you $500,000 more or $1 million more, can you invest it and get the same return on investment as you did previously? And my answer would always be yes, but it was only yes because every time we talked about spending money on something, we had the discipline to think about what is going to be the return on this. And nothing ever goes 100% perfect, but if you know that you need to hit a certain metric of return on investment, a lot of decisions become quite easy. Because when people say things like, I don't know, maybe we should buy $10,000 of t-shirts. Like, I mean, you can do that. There's nothing wrong with t-shirts. I'm not making fun of t-shirts, but it just sort of like, some things are just quite silly and won't lead to any return. And so if you spend money on things that don't lead to a return on investment, then you have to make up for it in the other dollars you spend, right? You have to even get a better result out of the other channels. And the other thing is that some channels will be a lot more expensive. Like online advertising on Google pay-per-click is one of the most expensive channels. And B2B, a lot of companies will end up spending something like $300-$400 a lead. Is sort of how the math works out. Whereas email marketing is a lot less cost per lead. And so the answer might be, well, just do all email marketing then and don't do the Google. But you can't do that, because if you do that, you won't get to the scale that you need to get to if you don't leverage a channel. So the question is, what is the right mix, right? And so that's, I think, where the art and science of the ROI measurement comes in. Does that make sense?
It does. It makes complete sense. And it's just so great, Eric, to hear you saying exactly what I'm both thinking and trying to preach, you know, on my side. And you say it so eloquently there. That was just so clear that this is the big deal. This is why we do marketing. Okay, there's a load of other reasons, but I wanted to kind of really sort of understand from you, and again, from your very unique position, really, sort of in the markets that you're in, how do we sort of square up this whole idea of marketing is partly strategic, so it's partly about creating brand in the medium to longer term, with this whole ROI piece in the short term, this immediate need to get a financial return? How does that kind of play out? If we're still seeing marketing as this investment, to me, I would also then be wanting to see this longer term kind of positioning and kind of brand sort of equity being built. Does that kind of come into play in your markets?
Yeah, and it's interesting, as I've worked in companies that have operations in different countries, the approach can be different geographically is the first thing I'd say. Us crazy Americans, we're like, just put together $10 million and have a go at it and be really aggressive, right? I think when I've worked with companies in the UK, branding has always perhaps been a bigger part of it, because some of the more aggressive, direct demand generation things were culturally just not as common in the UK, is sort of what I observed over time. But the answer to your question is branding versus demand gen. What's the right balance of that? And I think a lot of people get that mix wrong. And when I say that, I've come up through the demand gen side, so I would always tilt towards 80 or 90% of the focus being on demand gen, and 10 or 20% being on branding, largely because you can't get the growth of high growth. In my case, a lot of companies wanting 100% growth a year, you can't get that growth from branding and awareness. You'll get growth from it, but you won't get that extremely high growth. And so the majority needs to be on demand generation, in my opinion, especially at the earlier stages for companies. I think at the earlier stages, a lot of companies will overspend on the branding and awareness. They'll do like the majority of their focus on that and a minority focus on demand gen. And then ultimately the business fails. And so it's about having the right mix. Some people have asked me over time, like, well, what if it's 50-50? I'm like, well, it's really hard for businesses to succeed. Like the deck is really stacked against you as an entrepreneur. And so my advice is, I would over-index on the demand gen, which drives the growth, because the deck's already sort of stacked against businesses succeeding, you know, in the first 5 years. So I would do everything I can to ensure more on growth and demand gen in the early days. Where I have seen effective investment in branding is when companies get to a later stage. Like the one company I worked with and followed sort of that advice, and after 7 or 8 years, they were ready to go public in the next year or two coming up. That's when it made sense to spend more on things like PR and branding and awareness, because people needed to understand at a broader business level, investors needed to understand, you know, the company. We needed broader business awareness for that. Hey, this business that we're in, this is a thing. This is a market segment, and this is a good business. And so that's when it made sense to start spending a lot of money on PR and those sort of branding activities, so people knew who the company was and what the company did, even if they weren't really a prospective customer.
That's so interesting advice. And I think, you know, for a lot of us, we need to probably take a step back from, you know, exactly what we're doing today and kind of listen to that and kind of critique that balance, because I would say probably a lot of people listening to this, and I'll kind of look myself in the mirror here and say, question mark, have we got this right? Are we actually doing it right now? Because if you're absolutely right then, Eric, I mean, that the way you've described it would follow, kind of quite true to the speed that everything is changing right now with AI and all the other kind of, you know, emerging technologies, you know, just literally increasing the pace of everything, including product development, including, you know, speed to market, et cetera, et cetera. So it would kind of ring true that if you just think about the long-term brand, you're going to miss the boat because you're not, the wave is going to come through and you're not going to be actually on it, riding it full stop because you were distracted by this much, much bigger wave out on the horizon, but you've already drowned. So it's, yeah, it's a really interesting point that really for us all to kind of revisit how we've thought about where the priority should be. Is there, once you kind of make that judgment, either if you're at startup, pre-startup, or you're more established, is there then a certain narrative or kind of storytelling that somebody who is a marketer through and through, so, you know, that is what their role is, that's all they've ever known, but then needing to talk to other disciplines. So either it's a VC and you've got the finance person from that VC coming through and really wanting to go deep onto the numbers, or you've got somebody, we started off the conversation talking about people. So you've got a recruiter or you've got an HR person coming in to critique this business plan or this model or this kind of tender for some investment. Is there a certain kind of mix or style of storytelling that really works when it comes to looking for more investment, be it an internal kind of investment, so it's budget from, you know, an existing budget if you're a large business, or if you're a startup, you might be looking outside for an investor. Is there a kind of a typical perfect narrative or perfect storytelling that conveys the best sort of message for a marketer to learn?
So I am often shocked by how hard it is for founders and companies to explain who they are, what they do, and what they stand for. That's really a story that people need to tell. And sometimes people are doing very specific things with their products and they have very specific customers. But sometimes people really trip over themselves in being able to explain that. And one of the things is when you look at website analytics, I like this example of how you need to be articulate about who you are and what you do and why you do it, is because people go to a B2B website and they'll spend 20 seconds on your website to determine if they want to learn more. 20 seconds is the amount of time you have, right? So when you think about that's the amount of time you have to at a high level and the hero image part of the site, usually like in a couple sentences max, maybe the tagline, maybe an image, you know, really explain who you are and what you do. That's really hard for people to get crisp on it. And I've spent so many days and so much time talking with teams about helping them to get that articulation out to their story, because there's so many companies that do so many things that how are you distinguishing yourself? So if they do understand who you are and what you do, like how are you then different than all the other companies? And I also just, every time I go to an event and I see just a wall of logos, it's very interesting to me because I'm just like, you know, I don't know what any of these companies do. Just from looking at their logo and their name, like, and, you know, even some of the most successful companies in tech, you look at their name and you're like, Chili Piper. I mean, I think it's something to do with calendaring, like Calendly, but not Calendly. Right? Like, so it is really important that you find a way to describe who you are and what you do in a crisp way, not just for investors, but just broadly for the market, because I think your marketing will be wildly ineffective if you don't nail that basic product marketing thing. And then one final thing I'll say is that one company I work for, I actually wrote the S1 document for when we went public with the lawyers and the finance people. And it was all just about, for me, my part of it, outside of the legal and the finance part that others were doing, was to tell the story of, we created this category and we are the leader in this category. And here are the 20 reasons why those things are true. And the result of the IPO was every single person that was pitched on the investor roadshow invested and the IPO was oversubscribed because they got the story. And we actually made a 3-minute video that we played at the beginning of a 30-minute pitch to all those investors. And you only have 30 minutes when people are looking at investing millions of dollars in your business. And you have to explain everything you do in your business and why it's great and why people should invest millions of dollars. And you have literally maximum of 30 minutes. And so even in those cases where it's like not the website, but it's like with investors, you have a very limited amount of time to be able to explain in the most compelling way who you are and what you do. And I think having people who can tell that story for you is really important.
Mm. So is it made up then? I just want to make this super practical for somebody who's listening to this and thinking, I need to do this. I need to do this because I need to pitch to my boss for, you know, some more budget for this year because we're underfunded, or this is somebody who's got a side hustle. They're good to go, but they're looking for some outside investment. Is it the mix of the three key elements that we've been talking about, and have we missed anything? So what I've picked up, Eric, from the conversation is that it's product, it's people, and obviously it's profit, the ROI, the return that the investor is going to get. If those are the big three, is there anything else? Are there any other ingredients that will make this perfect sauce?
The final one I would say is to add to it is, I think it's about having a scalable, repeatable process. So first you come up with the marketing you want to do and you test it and you do a step function. So if you can spend, for example, a small amount like $5,000 on something and you can prove that it works and you step it up and you just keep stepping it up and then you can scale it and you can repeat it. That's really the key to deciding should you just invest more, because some people make the mistake of they'll focus on one marketing channel or tactic and they don't realize that one channel and tactic won't scale. And just to give an example of what I mean is that some people would say, I talked to one company and they said, well, we spent $10,000 on LinkedIn and we got this result, so we're going to spend $1 million on it. And I was like, that's not going to work because you're not going to be able to scale that one tactic on LinkedIn to $1 million. There's not enough volume for what they were doing in the way they were doing the advertising. The volume wasn't available. And so when you go to make those investment decisions, if you don't have a scalable, repeatable process and you haven't tested it and you're not stepping it up to prove it, then that's where I think things go off the rails, because you never want to just jump in and do like a Super Bowl commercial for $50 million until you've proven that like you're really good at TV advertising, for example. And I think that is a big mistake that a lot of companies make, which ends up to an investment loss in a lot of cases, because I mean, a lot of people lose a lot of money on doing marketing like Super Bowl commercials because they didn't test it. And I just think it's, if you miss that ingredient, you could end up with a bad result.
Eric, this has been just so valuable. And I know the audience here listening to this are going to be thinking, wow, I've taken so many notes, but I need more. I need to be constantly fed Eric's wisdom. You've got a podcast, haven't you? Do you want to share how people can kind of connect with you and keep in touch with this thing? Because this is never going to go away. It doesn't matter what stage your business is at or what stage your marketing career you've reached so far. This is relevant to each and every one of us. So I want to put people in touch with you and your podcast. Where should they go?
Absolutely. It's the Remarkable Marketing Podcast. And the spirit of curiosity, like we were talking about earlier, it's really about having marketers be on as guests and in just 10 to 15 minutes, they tell a story about the best marketing they've ever done. And the goal is really for other marketers and business leaders who listen to take inspiration from that. Because we've talked about a lot of theory and concepts here today. I've told a few stories, but I really love to learn via hearing stories from other people about what they've done and how they've done it. And so that's my passion, is because I'm curious and I like learning from other people. I love hearing the stories. There's lots of great stories there. You know, I produce at least a couple episodes a week of people who are really doing remarkable, epic things. And it inspires me and the work that I do with the companies, the VC firm, and my startup. I have a startup that I've self-funded and do the marketing for, it called Workverse. It's a mobile app for business networking in the US. So you can check that out too, but definitely encourage people to check out the podcast.
Brilliant. And I know it's going to be on my list of bookmark favorites shortly, because I want to follow this conversation through as well and be listening to, you know, all the amazing examples. And I would certainly advocate that, you know, emulating stuff that you hear is working so well, much as Eric has given us many, many great examples of things to think about today. It is about then following others who are kind of taking Eric's advice and going down that route and exploring and adventuring and being curious. So this has been really, really useful. I know, Eric, we've only scratched the surface of many of these topics, but I think for a lot of people, that's a really, really valuable start. So I really appreciate your time, curiosity, energy, and passion today. It's been a really great conversation.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Neil.